Today on Vox Talks Economics, the UK's macro financial policies, who they affect and what affects them. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips, and every week we're bringing you the best new research in economics. So remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. Since the global financial crisis, the UK has introduced reforms to its banking sector and used innovative macroprudential and monetary policy tools to maintain stability. But the UK is also an international financial centre, and so does this policy framework create spillovers in other places? And do influences from elsewhere affect stability in the UK? A team of researchers, three quarters of whom are based at the Bank of England, have just published a paper on this topic. Thorsten Beck of the European University Institute and CEPR is, well, he's the one that isn't at the Bank of England, and he joins me now. Welcome back, Thorsten.
Hello, Tim. Good to join you.
We better mention right at the beginning that although your co-authors do work at the Bank of England, this doesn't represent the Bank of England's views, does it?
Yeah, well, not the official view, that's for sure, yes.
Not the official view, yes. Okay, so I'll give you an easy question to start off with, a small one. Can you describe this institutional framework that we have now and the system of committees that govern the bank's macroprudential monetary policy?
Yes, well, thanks, Tim. So the Bank of England is responsible for both price and financial stability. And to discharge of this responsibility, it takes decision within three committees that are each responsible for one of the policy areas. We have the Monetary Policy Committee for price stability. We have the Prudential Regulation Committee, which is responsible for micro-prudential supervision of financial institutions. And we have the Financial Policy Committee, which is responsible for macro-prudential supervision. Now, what's the difference between micro and macro? Micro is basically regulating, supervising individual banks and investment firms, whereas the macroprudential side looks more at the overall picture, like the interdependences between different financial institutions, which institutions are especially important systemically speaking, and also taking into account that even if every single institution looks okay, looks healthy, that doesn't necessarily mean that the whole system is healthy. That's kind of what we sometimes refer to as the fallacy of composition. Think about credit booms and busts. 2006, 2007, the financial sector looked healthy because each of the banks looked healthy. But we know, of course, the fragility had built up and then ultimately it came out in 2008. Now, you have these three committees. They are independent of each other, but there is an overlap in membership across these of by senior officials of the Bank of England, and the governor of the Bank of England is the chair of each of these three committees.
This overlapping system, is it unusual compared to other central banks? Does it have particular advantages, disadvantages?
So it is a very specific structure that we can see in the Bank of England, but there are different models. And you can see the structure of the Bank of England maybe as some kind of a compromise. On the one hand, there is this argument that one institution should be responsible for all three areas, for price stability, monetary stability, micro and macro prudential stability. The reason being, these three policy areas really hang together. They influence each other so that you need some coordination between the three. Now, if these three areas are typically together, then this would be typically in the central bank, like in the Bank of England. And the argument here goes that the Monetary Policy Authority can actually benefit from supervisory information that they can gain by supervising banks, which can inform and lead to better monetary policy decisions. At the same time, supervisors can benefit from typically very high reputation and the independence, the political independence of central banks, which standalone supervisory authorities typically do not have. I mean, to give you one example, in Germany, the supervisory authority is basically under the Ministry of Finance, so much closer to the political sphere than, for example, the Bank of England would be. So all of these arguments tell us, well, it's maybe good to have all of them together. But there are also arguments against putting all of these policy responsibility together. And one is that if the central bank takes on responsibility for financial stability, and if something goes wrong in the financial sector, ultimately that reflects bad on the reputation and maybe ultimately also the political independence of the central bank. So it's a negative spillover effect in terms of reputation. And a second kind of counter argument for having them all together is that one policy area might dominate the other. So monetary policy decisions are being influenced by problems in the financial sector or the other way around. Now, and especially concerning this last point, I think this is one of the reasons why the Bank of England has said, yes, we're going to have all of these policy areas in one institution, but we're going to have independent committees who decide independently of each other. Now, if you compare this to other institutions, again, you can see lots of different type of structures around the world. Just to give you two examples, in the ECB, you have, of course, the monetary policy arm, and you have the primarily microprudential bank supervision, which sometimes is referred to as the SSM, the single supervisory mechanism. In this case, there's a clear firewall between these two sides. There are separate boards. There's the governing council, the supervisory board. But again, there is a certain personal overlap between these two boards in the sense that you have the national governor sitting in the governor council and often the deputy governor or the head of supervision, which is under the national governor, sitting in the supervisory board. So there's kind of, again, some interlinkages. You have other models. Let's just take one example, Sweden, where these two areas are completely separate. You have the Swedish Riksbank responsible for monetary policy, and then you have Finansinspektionen, the responsible for both the micro and the macroprudential regulation, completely separate from the Riksbank. The Riksbank doesn't have any financial stability responsibility except for the payment system, which hangs directly together with monetary policy. So again, very different models. You can say, yes, certain characteristics of the Bank of England structures are unique, but again, they reflect what we've learned over the last 10, 12, 15 years in terms of experiences, whether responsibility should be together or separated.
Okay, so day-to-day in the Bank of England, what are the activities that are delivering financial system stability, price stability? I'm asking the big questions today, aren't I, Thorsten?
Yes, indeed. So, first of all, if you think about price and financial stability, there's a big difference between the two. Mm-hmm. Because the price stability you can clearly define. It is around 2%, give or take. Financial stability cannot really be defined in such a positive way. You define it typically in a negative way. If you don't have a financial crisis, if you don't have systemic financial distress, there must be financial stability. So it's much harder to define. And you never know, is there financial stability because the supervisor has done an extraordinarily good job, or it's just they have been lucky. So it's very different, the responsibility, the accountability of financial stability from price stability. Now going to your question in terms of the daily activities, well, so the monetary policy, it's pretty clear when you look at the newspaper's headlines, you have interest rates going up or down, you have sometimes quantitative easing. So very specific decisions that were the authorities try to influence the inflationary pressures in the economy. Financial stability, again, we have these two sides. What we typically don't observe is the microprudential, because these are supervision of individual financial institutions where they do their day-to-day job in terms of off-site, on-site supervision, looking at the data, and maybe telling a bank, well, you might need some additional capital, stress testing them, whether they can withhold big pressure, big stress if a big shock happens. And on the other hand, you have the macroprudential, that we're going to come to in a moment, which really looks again at the big picture. Doesn't look at the trees, but looks at the forest. And here, the macroprudential authority, now specifically in the UK, the Financial Policy Committee, has a couple of tools where they can influence the systemic situation in the British financial system. What so far they have been using are two types of tools. One is a so-called counter-cyclical capital buffer, which is basically too much lending, too much excitement going on, pull away the punch bowl a little bit, forcing banks to put additional capital to reduce the incentives to lend more. Or the other way around, think about Brexit vote 2016, think about the COVID shot 2020. Countercyclical capital buffer is being lowered, sometimes down to zero, in order to give banks as much space as possible to do additional lending. The other tool that has been used to a certain extent, especially in the housing markets, are to target specific lending market, lending segments, for example, by putting a cap on loan-to-value ratios or at the debt-to-income ratios, or forcing banks to limit their mortgages to certain very risky borrower segments.
This framework was set up after the global financial crisis, in response to the global financial crisis. It's had a test since. So first draft of history, how well did it cope with the problems around COVID-19?
Well, I think it did respond relatively well. And I think here also the mixed structure of the Bank of England has actually benefited this response. You have separate independent committees, but you have also this overlap and you have the same chair for all of the three committees. All three committees came out at the same time in March 2020 with a common package of measures to reassure financial institutions, financial markets, and mitigate the shock as much as possible. Specifically, the Monetary Policy Committee reduced the interest rates, the so-called bank rate, by 50 basis points. They introduced additional funding schemes, especially for small, mid-sized enterprises. The Financial Policy Committee, the FPC, reduced the counter-cyclical buffer that I just mentioned down to zero. And in addition, it did something which we don't actually have seen before in this field, which is forward guidance for macroprudential policy. They said, sorry, you're not going to get another rise in the counter-cyclical capital buffer until 2 years. So the earliest it's going to be in 2 years, banks might have to put more capital. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the Prudential Regulation Committee basically said, well, banks, you can use all available capital and liquid buffer to a large extent to keep up lending to the economy. This has had a very strong signaling function to markets, to the economy, that the Bank of England in its totality was aware of the situation, that they would do whatever it takes, to quote Mario Draghi, and signal that they are in this together and that there is a coordinated effort. We have some similar responses elsewhere. I mean, again, just to take the example from across the channel, in Frankfurt, you had the governing council of the ECB announcing additional refinancing option, very loose monetary policy. And at the same day, the supervisory board, so the SSM, announced that the banks at the direct supervision of the ECB can fully use capital and liquidity buffers, including the so-called Pillar 2 guidance. So again, I think from this viewpoint, yes, the reforms after the global financial crisis have been put to test. And at least in this initial phase, yes, they have passed the test.
As you point out in the paper, London is an international financial center. But is it as important as an international financial center? Is it as connected as it was, well, before the global financial crisis? We've had lots happen since then, specifically Brexit.
First of all, yes, it is a big international financial center. Mm. The UK is host to over 200 international banks, and 50% of all assets that are held by banks in the UK are held by foreign banks, 50%, half of it. There's over $5 trillion in cross-border claims, so claims by banks located in the UK and borrowers outside the UK. Now, this has reduced a little bit since 2008, when it was 7 trillion, but it's still larger than the other G7 economies, including the US and Japan. So also compared to the size of the economy, yes, it is still quite important.
And as the UK is an international financial center, does that mean that shocks in other economies spill over into the UK economy?
Yes, very much so. Mm. I mean, just to give you one example, there has been a study also by the Bank of England looking over a 20-year period. And basically, the study found that about half of the variation in economic activity in the UK and almost all variation in UK financial market condition can be explained by global shocks. So yes, it is a very different economy, both the real side, but especially even more so the financial side, which is kind of in line with what we've heard for the past 10, 15 years, is that there is this global financial cycle. And then as an international financial center, the UK is really, really open to any fluctuations in it.
Clearly, that's going to be important for macro financial policies, isn't it? How closely does the bank monitor this?
Oh, very much so. So they have this so-called annual cyclical scenario, which examines the potential impact of a hypothetical adverse scenario on the health of the banking system and individual institutions. Because don't forget, subsidiaries, not branches, but subsidiaries of foreign banks in the UK are also subject to supervision by the Bank of England. So they're also responsible for them. By doing this kind of annual cyclical scenario, this allows both the Financial Policy Committee and the Prudential Regulatory Authority to assess the resilience of the banking sector to a range of adverse shocks and see whether the financial sector and the individual institutions can withstand such shocks. There are two elements to that. There are the so-called vulnerabilities, which are tensions that build up over time. Think about banks being over-leveraged, for example. And then the more shorter-term risks, which are crystallizing or are about to crystallize. So this could be certain shocks, again, Brexit, COVID-19, or maybe some geopolitical uncertainty. So in all of this, this then feeds back this analysis feeds them back into decisions on the countercyclical capital buffer that the FPC takes. And just to give you one example, for 2019, this analysis that I just quoted, the annual cyclical scenario, basically showed that the fraction of globally caused potential reduction in GDP in a stress situation is larger than the reduction that would be caused by a domestic shock.
Crikey. Well, let's look at it in the other direction as well. Does the impact of UK monetary policy have spillover effects elsewhere?
Yes, it does indeed. And that's also what we look at in this paper. So what we show is that if you have a change, a surprise change in UK monetary policy, so let's say the interest rate increases, this reduces UK-based banks' external lending growth. So UK-based banks lend less abroad. Why? Because they can get a higher return in the UK. And we also specifically look at the economic effect. So, for example, 25 basis points, which is a typical change in the interest rate, an increase in monetary policy would reduce UK's bank external lending by 4.6 percentage point over 1 year. Now, again, to highlight the role of being an international financial center, this is primarily driven by foreign subsidiaries and foreign branches. So these are the ones who say, well, let's not lend as much to our parent banks or borrowers in our home countries, but rather let's keep lending here in the UK, or not lending necessarily in the home countries, but let's say to third countries.
These numbers are probably quite a lot larger than a lot of people assume. So how important is the conduct of policy in the UK for global financial stability?
Again, it is, because any surprise in monetary policy in the UK has implication of how much foreign banks in the UK lend to the rest of the world. The good news, so to say, is that countries know that they can mitigate this effect with macroprudential tools. So similarly, as the FPC can use macroprudential tools to mitigate the impact of global shocks on the UK financial system, other countries can use macroprudential tools to mitigate the impact of monetary policy shocks in the UK on capital flows to their own countries. And again, this is a relatively big effect. For example, if the recipient country of capital flows from the UK has a tighter macroprudential policy toolbox in place, then the impact of a surprise tightening of monetary policy in the UK can offset these spillover effects to a large extent. So which means that there is not as much reversal of capital flows from the UK into this country, staying in the UK, but rather still flowing to the other country because of the macroprudential tools that are in place there. Not all of these macroprudential tools are equally effective in that. This macroprudential toolbox is a very diverse one. I mean, you have a reserve requirement, you have additional capital buffers, and you have these loan-to-value ratios and lending restrictions for specific sectors. And it's only the latter. So housing loan restrictions, lending restrictions to specific sectors, these are the macroprudential tools in third countries that help these countries mitigate the impact of UK monetary policy shocks on capital flow into these countries. So again, it goes both ways. Global capital flows can impact the UK. Macroprudential tools can help mitigate these effects. And the same holds the other way around. UK monetary policy shocks on the rest of the world, other countries can use macroprudential tools to mitigate the impact of these shocks on their financial system.
Macrofinancial policy is fascinating these days and surprising as well. Thanks ever so much, Thorsten. It's a really interesting, very clear paper as well. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you.
The paper, if you want to read it, I hope you do, is called Macrofinancial Policy in an International Financial Centre, the UK Experience Since the Global Financial Crisis. And it's discussion paper 16860 at CPR. The authors are Thorsten Beck, Simon Lloyd, Dennis Reinhardt and Rhiannon Sauerbutz. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week, we bring you the most important latest research. So if you want to know what you're going to be reading in journals 18 months from now, listen to Vox Talks Economics today. And when you subscribe on your podcast platform, your phone immediately has access to almost 200 episodes. So whatever type of economics you want to listen to, there's a Vox Talk for you.